Brad Newton, Dr. Also a PhD in geology, functions as our secretary for the geologist, also consulting with Connor Phillips, and then Tim Cree, also a geologist, hydrogeologist, who represents also the Woodlands Mutual Water Company. So as you can see, we have quite a bit of horsepower up here, and the purpose of tonight, particularly given the small group, is to do two things. One is to update you as members of the public, I see some decision makers here also, update you on our 2009 annual report. It might feel a little stale because 2009 is a long time ago. We've had quite a bit of rainfall since then. But sorry that we can't look too far ahead. We're going to focus tonight on what was in that technical report. I have a couple other key personnel I forgot to mention. Toby Moore, who's not going to be here this evening, I don't think, but we have Kim Peterson in the audience with us representing Golden State Water Company. Toby's another highly qualified groundwater person who serves on our technical group. And then Jacqueline Frederick, who is an ag representative who is not here with us tonight. So again, we're going to focus on the 2009 report, so you might be curious as to what the conditions are in 2010, but you're going to have to wait a little bit until we release the 2010 annual report. So it'll be a look back today. So we're going to start off with a map here. And this map describes the overall Santa Maria groundwater basin and specifically outlines the limits of that basin, a very large structure in our area. And you can see there the different colors, the different management areas. And of course, we're today talking about the Napomo Mesa management area. Next slide, please. So blow up of that area, and you can see some of the different water utilities and pumpers of groundwater that are represented in the area, including Woodlands Mutual Water Company, serving ultimately about 1,300 homes as it builds out. The Napomo Community Services District, most of you are familiar with. ConocoPhillips is a private pumper. Also Rural Water Company. I see Mr. Baker here representing Rural, and Golden State Water Company, which is an investor-owned utility. So that's sort of the different urban purveyors that provide water within the management area. Next slide. Well, I'm going to stumble a little bit through the history and the purpose of the tech group. Historically, Jackie's been here as an attorney to present this, so I won't go into great detail. Some of you might know even more about it than I. Basically, the technical group was formed as a result of litigation over groundwater rights in our area, which was initiated all the way back in 1997. It's been 13 years now. The parties ultimately agreed, after much discussion and legal wrangling, to a settlement, which we call the stipulation. So you may hear that word a number of times tonight. Stipulation is a document that sets forth what a number of the parties agreed to. And that was formalized by the court in 2008. And then as part of the stipulation, a technical group was formed to try to get those representatives that are focused on the technical issues working together to collectively address groundwater issues in the Napomo area. And the court saw the wisdom of that convening this group, which has been operating since about early 2008. Next slide. The technical group again includes representatives from a number of parties: Golden State Water, an investor-owned utility, ConocoPhillips, Napomo, CSC, there's an ag representative, and then the Woodlands Mutual Water Company. Also, Rural Water Company participates in many of our meetings, though they don't have a formal representative on the technical group. The way that we conduct our business is that we have technical meetings where we look at technical issues, we build consensus among the experts in the group, and that's how we move forward. So what you hear tonight is not the result of a majority vote among these experts, it's a consensus, and so it takes quite a bit of effort to build that. The technical group meetings can be attended by any of the stipulating parties. and the work products are released not so much through individual group members, but through the court. It's a court-mandated process. Our reports are actually filed with the court and then available online to any of the members of the public who are interested, and we'll tell you how to get there at the end of the presentation. The way that we're going to run tonight is after these introductory comments, we're going to have a time for open questions and answers, and I'll sort of moderate that, and we'll present that to the panel to answer your questions. So feel free to jot down things that confuse you, and we'll address them from there. Some of the key objectives of the group, number one is to devise and maintain a monitoring plan. We want to make sure we have our finger on the pulse of the basin, periodically looking at different factors that affect quality, quantity, and other parameters that would be of interest to us to make sure we keep those beneficial uses in this basin alive. We prepare an annual report to report on the health of the aquifer, the health of the groundwater basin, and then we file that with the court. And then to identify any conditions that need corrective action. So it's not enough just to monitor it, we're also looking to take action when necessary. You're going to hear about those actions tonight. I know many of you have quite a bit of groundwater experience. Many of you own your own wells, so this might seem a little rudimentary to you, but for that one or two individuals who might benefit from this, we're going to go through a quick little primer on groundwater. Groundwater is currently the sole source of water for the Nipomo area. No surface water sources at this point, and so whatever you're using, you're pumping out of the ground, or a purveyor is pumping out of the ground. Water is basically stored within the soil particles in the ground, if you're sort of unfamiliar with groundwater basin. And it moves as a result of pressure beneath the ground from an area of high pressure to an area of lower pressure. We're going to talk about some of the basic factors here. Next slide, please. So first, this word aquitard, you're going to hear this tonight from time to time. A synonym for this is a confining layer. When our basin was formed years ago, there was a number of layers. Some of the sediments are permeable. Many of them are not. There's clay layers within our basin that form a barrier to any flow of water. Those become very important as we analyze groundwater conditions. This basin is basically, you can imagine it as a large bowl of rock with different sediments on top of it that hold water. And we know that our basin exists not in just one uniform layer of sand, but in multiple layers, sometimes very complicated. Next slide. So to access this water, of course, we put a hole in the ground down to where water exists, and we keep it open with a plastic or steel pipe. And then part of that pipe is screened and has holes that allow the entry of that water, put a pump down the hole, and we have it operating well. So in the next slide, you'll see some of the graphs that the groundwater hydrologists look at and study. And it shows basically the different layers, some sandy layers, some permeable, some impermeable. But it's definitely not as simple as when you open a textbook on groundwater and see a nice thick sandy layer. It's laid down in a very complex structure. Sometimes is not continuous. It's hard to analyze and requires many different data points. Of course, the confusing thing is the only data points we have is when we drill a hole often, and that's we have to interpret that data point to draw graphs like this. That was this one was drawn by the Department of Water Resources. Next slide, please. So groundwater measurements, how do we monitor the health of this basin? We spend a lot of time looking at analyzing water levels. We do that at least semi-annually, once in the spring, once in the fall, because those are sort of the limiting conditions, best case, worst case, before it starts raining. We look at water quality primarily through the normal samples that purveyors take. We're all continuously sampling our water on at least a three-year cycle for every constituent that's on the EPA list. And we're always looking for ways to reduce uncertainty in our measurements. We'll talk about that a little bit more. So the word that was probably on all of your minds when you walked in the door, seawater intrusion, that is probably more than anything the one issue that we're looking for, guarding against. Seawater intrusion is basically the movement of salt water into a freshwater aquifer. And that's our key technical objective to avoid this. You've probably read in the paper there are communities on the Central Coast that have seawater intrusion problems. And it's very difficult to reverse those problems once they occur. Our groundwater basin actually extends out into the coast. And therefore, we have this connection with the ocean where we have conditions if we pump too much that can create the potential for seawater intrusion. What causes it? Generally, overpumping. Actually, all the conditions that I know of result from overpumping of a basin, dropping those water levels that give a chance for the seawater to come in. I can tell you that as of now, there's no current evidence of seawater intrusion within our sub area. So please do report that to you last year and again this year. Next slide. So in monitoring the health of our basin, where do we actually look at the conditions in the basin? We have really two groups of wells that we look at, both in terms of the water levels in the wells, also in terms of quality. The first group of wells we call sentinel wells. Those are right near the coast, and they would be, we call them sentinel wells because they are first, they're our first line of defense for seawater intrusion. If those conditions occur, they would occur first in these wells that are highlighted now in yellow. So for those wells, we're looking at both the water levels and the quality of the water. And for inland health of the basin, we have a number of key wells that we identified, primarily because, number one, we had good information on the wells, and number two, they're spaced out throughout the inland area, and we use these to form sort of an overall average index that gives us a feeling for the health of the inland areas of our basin. So again, coastal wells, there to detect seawater intrusion in any form, and then the key wells to look at the inland areas. With these two tools, these groups of wells, we form a series of water shortage conditions to say, when this happens, we need to take some action. So we're going to talk about those again tonight. Those of you who were here last year, you're familiar with this. And this was basically mandated by the port that this technical group identify some specific triggers where we needed to take action. Next slide. So there are two triggers that we're going to talk about. These were mandated within the court documents. The first is a potentially severe water shortage condition, and the second is a severe water shortage condition. And last year, if you were here, we talked about an analogy to a red light and a yellow light, where the potentially severe condition would be analogous to a yellow light. We see concerns coming, we need to take some initial actions, get ready for some larger actions. The severe condition, more like the red light, we need to take immediate action. So we're going to define those here for you tonight. The potentially severe condition really is designed to reflect water levels that would require some voluntary conservation measures, would require additional supply or other steps that may be necessary to avoid further decline. So again, that's the yellow light. We see trouble coming. We need to take some corrective actions, although it's not so urgent that we all have to let our lawns die and do other extreme measures, but we do need to look at alternative sources of supply, which we've done. So how do we define a potentially severe water shortage condition? Looking at coastal wells, we want to make sure that those coastal wells always have to be safely above the level of seawater. Some of you might know that seawater, because of its salt level, is actually more dense than fresh water. And so we know from physics that we have to maintain safe water levels above sea level in order to prevent the water from coming in due to the greater density of seawater. We also look at water quality in those coastal wells, and if we begin to see constituents that are consistent with seawater, the big one is chloride, then we'll begin to raise the flag if it goes above 250 milligrams per liter level, which is about half of what you would see in a maximum drinking water standard. And then in the inland side, we have, again, these groups of key wells, 7-8 key wells, And we averaged those well depths and normalized those to create an index. And we will show you a graph of that index in a second, but 31.5 is our trigger for a potentially severe condition. Severe water shortage condition, which I'm happy we're not reporting that tonight, but so you know how it's defined. It would be a condition where the lowest historic water levels beneath our NMMA as a whole have been reached, or that conditions constituting seawater intrusion have been reached. So basically, if we are lower in average water levels than we've ever been, or that we're really detecting seawater intrusion, so something real is happening to the basin, we have to hit the stop button and look at some immediate actions. So how do we define those? In the coastal wells, we looked at water quality. If we get up to 500 milligrams per liter as fluoride, we're beginning to hit that drinking water standard. We've got clear evidence that seawater intrusion may be occurring. And then inland, we've dropped water levels, and you may remember from a previous slide, all the way from the potentially severe level of over 30 feet all the way down to 16.5 feet. So water levels are significantly depressed. Now, it's important to know that this is not just any time of the year. This is measured in the spring water levels. So in the fall, we might have some low conditions because of lack of rainfall during the summer. But we measure this spring to spring to spring. So when I report an average water level, it's a spring level. So here's a nice chart that shows a couple of lines. The one red line is the key well index that we call it, and that is that index that tracks sort of, I guess you could call it an average, although it's not quite an average, of the wells, key wells within the inland area. And you can see how that's tracked over time. You're able to go back with historical data and track that over time, and you can see the drought that occurred, some of you may remember, in the early 90s. And that, of course, we're also been in a drought cycle the last number of years, by the end of last year. You'll also see in blue a measure of the average rainfall that has occurred year over year. It's what's called a cumulative departure curve. I won't go into that tonight, but it's a measure of how the rainfall compares to our average amount. And you can see that basically the amount of rainfall we receive is a pretty good indicator of how our wells are going to behave. As you might expect, if you get more rainfall, water levels will respond to that eventually. Some water basins don't look like this. Some of them are so based on the amount of pumping that even a good rainfall year or a couple of years won't result in a good recovery of water levels. But we do have recovery in our area. And here you see, again, with the line that goes up and down, the key well index as it's changed over time. And the two trigger points, potentially severe and severe, one of the things that you'll notice immediately is that from time to time, we will go into the potentially severe area below that line. You saw it happen in the 90s, back in the 70s, it's happening now. So every time we have a significant drought cycle, we're going to go into that yellow light mode, and that makes sense. We want to be more cautious during those times when we have a potentially severe condition. And then you'll see the severe condition, which has never been reached within our NMMA area. And of course, we hope to avoid that. So what were our findings for 2009? Well, you're going to hear a summary tonight. You can read all the fine detail. We'll tell you how to get that off the web. Basically, our aquifer is in a potentially severe water shortage condition, similar to last year. In fact, the key well index is about at the same level as last year, declined just a bit at 28.1. The spring water levels, they've declined for the last 3 years. Again, this is 2009. This is a 2009 report before we had the good rain year. But we have seen declining water levels. We'll be very interested to see how that responds this year after we've had some decent rainfall during the El Nino condition. We do know that we're going to need significant additional technical work. You'll hear some of the things that we're working on tonight. But this is going to be an ongoing process. Every year our understanding gets deeper. We were able to report more detailed information, but we do have a lot of technical work to do. And total production from our groundwater aquifers, which got cut off there, was about 11,000 acre feet. One of the charts that is probably the most fundamental that our experts look at is the groundwater contour chart. And here you'll see an example of spring water levels from 2009. The blue lines reflect the elevation of the water actually in the ground. So that if you see a 10, it doesn't mean a surface elevation of 10. It means in the ground, we can measure down, say, 200 feet, measure the water level, and compute how that compares to sea level. So that 10 in the middle means 10 feet above sea level. That makes sense. And so we draw these contour maps to figure out which way the water is flowing, whether we have conditions that concern us. And if you do one click, Bonnie, that's an area that we're watching very closely. It's that area sort of between our management area and the five cities area. And we have seen some declining water levels year over year in that area that's being watched carefully by the technical group. And also, if you click another time, you'll see what we call a pumping depression. And this is the area where we have many of the urban supply wells that, if you live either in the Nipomo area or in the Golden State Service area, some of the key supply wells are in that pumping depression, and therefore the water levels have declined in it here in the spring down to 10 feet above sea level. So both areas that must be watched. If you click one more time, Lonnie. These are fall levels, and if you remember before, you had 10 feet in the pumping depression in the middle. In the fall, you're down to minus 10. You're actually below sea level. Now, we do have areas that are above sea level near the coast, so we're not drawing in seawater at this point, but again, these are areas to watch. You see the area to watch that we're down right at about sea level in our boundary with the northern cities area, the five cities area. And then our pumping depression is pretty pronounced there in the fall. So again, these are some of the key elements that the technical group looks at. Next slide, I'm sure it will be your favorite slide, waving lines. Really what this slide communicates is the water levels that are present at our coastal wells over time. And if you're looking carefully at that, you can see there's really no discernible trend there. So basically it says we continue to have strong and safe water levels at the coast. So when we say we have no evidence of seawater intrusion, it's because we're monitoring these coastal wells carefully. Some recommendations from the technical group. Again, when we state a recommendation, it isn't a majority vote. It's a consensus among the experts that you have here. Three types of recommendations. Go ahead. So the first is we're in a potentially severe water condition. We're looking for supplemental water. One recommendation of the group is to get supplemental water. The project that we're pursuing now is the intertidal with Santa Maria. That's one recommendation that we can implement that project. We also have a work plan for a number of technical things that we plan on doing this year, looking at how much water percolates through the root zone, looking at the conditions on our boundaries, a bunch of technical work that we're doing this year. So we have a work plan that's laid out for the remainder of this year. We adopted a well management plan. We're looking at furthering the use of that plan. It allows us to move water back and forth between the key purveyors. We've constantly updating our monitoring points and our methods to try to reduce uncertainty. We're looking ultimately at installing some automatic data collection equipment so that we don't have to physically go out and measure the water level. We can have a sensor that measures it for us over time, collects that data, logs it, so we have it year-round, not just twice a year. And to constantly look at the wells that we depend upon to make sure we have a very good understanding of the true surface elevation at each well. Not enough just to do a Google Earth, however much we love it, but we actually need to, over time, survey every well that we depend upon to make sure we know the precise elevation that well had. And we've done a fair amount of that surveying already. other technical recommendations. Continue to look for sources of good groundwater production data. All the purveyors, of course, report their data as a matter of course, but also looking for folks who might offer up either in small service areas or mutual water companies, ag producers, always trying to get a better handle on what's produced from this basin. It's a very important fundamental number that we need. Stream flow, one of the primary inputs to this basin, and recharging it over time is the amount of water in our streams, and we're looking for better ways to collect that data over time. There are stream gauges out there, but we're looking to improve upon that over time. Collection of data. We do have some weather stations in our management area. We want to collect data, not just periodically, but on a 365-day-a-year basis. And then, of course, to continue to review water shortage conditions and the way we measure those and set those triggers. Just because you see it here tonight doesn't mean that if we see new data, we won't respond to it in a different manner. This is a living set of documents that may be changed over time. We want to encourage participation in data collection. If you're one of those folks who have been identified as a key well, it's critical that you participate in our process. I think you'll benefit from that as you'll have data to look at your own water supply. Constantly looking for ways to better define the conditions in the ground. That's an ongoing work effort from this group. And we're even looking at the cost and the benefit of developing a groundwater model over time. That's a numerical computer model. We have a plan to get there over a number of years. It's very costly to do that, but we're looking at defining our conditions and developing that model over time. Collaboration with other management areas. We do have Santa Maria, the main Santa Maria Basin. They have their own management area. The five cities, Pismo, Grover, Rio Grande, and so forth, their area has their own management group. We are collaborating with those groups to make sure we're comparing notes, standardizing our processes, and so forth. Evaluation of a new monitoring well. If you looked at our Sentinel wells that were shown in yellow, we'd ultimately like to have another Sentinel well, sort of a data gap for us. Historically, we had one, but it's buried now under about 30 feet of sand. Can't be located, needs to be re-drilled. We have a plan to ultimately replace that. We have developed some data acquisition protocols so that when someone goes out to measure a water level, they all do it the same way. It's a lot more important than you would think the way that we do that. We have a protocol published now. Again, we have a well management plan between the purveyors if we need to move water back and forth. We've evaluated the placement of our stream gauges, and we continue to evaluate the geology within our basin. So some future goals. Continue to produce annual reports. I'm sure every year you will just be on the edge of your seat every April as we produce the next annual report. Grant funding efforts. There are some state grant funds for groups like ours to advance the science within the basin. We're all hoping we can compete very favorably for those grants when they become available, perhaps as soon as early next year. And so I've been involved, many of these gentlemen here have been involved in successful grant efforts in the past. And really, you can take a leap forward in your understanding when you get a significant grant. Define layers within our basin that confine or restrict the movement of water. Ultimately, develop a groundwater model. Look for improved ways to do analytical testing. Drill a new well in the Oso Flaco area for better monitoring near the coast, and then have some automatic equipment. One of the things that you'll hear tonight, this is a way that you can actually get, if you want to scribble down or if you grab a handout from the back, you can actually get the document online if you're interested. If you have any problems with that, feel free to grab one of my cards too. You can email me and I'll make sure that document gets in your hands. One of the things that you'll hear tonight is, how much water do we ultimately have available to pump? Are we pumping too much? Not enough? Where are we at with the amount of water we can pump from this basin? That's not an easy question. We often use the term safe yield. Some of you may have heard that term. Yes. Basically, the amount of water that you can pump from a basin without creating conditions that would be a problem for the basin, like seawater intrusion. So the amount you can pump, basically the safe yield that you can pump, is a process of defining how much water you can pump out safely before you create seawater intrusion. That's not a number that this technical group has published at this point. Ultimately, that's one of our targets to define the science to be able to define that number. So you might hear some questions in that regard here tonight. Been a great audience. I know that you're on the edge of your seat. What we want to do here, we have a small group. We don't have a microphone like we did last year to hand it to you. So if you do have a question, and I hope you do, please speak it loud so everybody can hear. And then we'll ask some of the panelists to respond. Yes?
We just had a good rain year in the winter of 2009. You indicated that there would be interesting to see by next year what the results are of the well test. How long does it actually take for a good rain year to percolate into the groundwater so that you actually see the results? Or is that something that's dependent on the ground constituents, I guess you call it, whatever makes up the ground?
Spent a lot of time talking about that question. It's an excellent question. Steve, you want to pitch that?
From what we can see, we get a fairly fast response, geologically, a fairly fast response. That doesn't mean it happens the next day, but we certainly see, as you can tell from when Rob showed what the rainfall patterns look like, and we can see what the groundwater levels look like, they certainly respond in the same year, so that we're getting that. So we expect that from this spring that we've had an improvement. What we don't know yet is whether we're out of that potentially severe condition yet or not, but it wouldn't be surprising if we were.
Good. Yes, Paul.
Another question. Here we're on the Napomo Mesa, and I look back over there, there's hills. And I always hear the term, you know, when it's going to be rain, that you're going to, the south-facing slopes will get, you know, much more rain than, you know, closer to the coast and stuff like that. Is that why you're so interested in the makeup of the basin and these aqua guards, that so you can tell how much might flow from that area into our groundwater basin?
That's a big part of it. Tim, what?
Yeah, the inflow to the basin is from just some of the basic elements of pre-percolation and precipitation, stream recharge, subsurface inflow from adjacent areas, like perhaps the hills, and then within the aquifers, there's multiple aquifers, and so obviously the ones closer to the surface get the rainfall recharge first, and then it has to work its way down, and sometimes the confining layers prevent that. So you actually have inflow coming into the basin and then reaching different parts of the basins at different times. So yes, we're very interested in the subsurface inflow, and we're trying to define what the formations are on the edges of our on the boundaries of our area, so that we can know how the water flows in and out of those areas. Yes.
Usually what happens when you end up doing some calculations on this, lots of times this is the number that people don't have any way to quantify. So the way they have all their numbers balanced, they say, oh, well, that must be X amount of water coming in from the
bedrock.
Foot bedrock, because that's the only way they can get that number. We hope we don't have to do that.
Questions? Yes?
Where do you think the water comes from the mesa? Since it's on a mesa and...
sources of it. Brad, you want to take one?
Sure. Principally, source of water to groundwater in the mesa is rainfall. And that percolates through the sediment, as we've been talking about. And the other major contribution is water that would flow in from an adjacent area in the subsurface. Many of the production wells in the mesa are screened, their screened interval is well below the land surface, and therefore can be available to water in sediments that may be connected to a larger footprint than just the mesa, or may be connected to an area adjacent to the mesa. So that water could be flowing in from the sides as well.
It's interesting too, as we use the water in our homes, those of us who have, say, septic systems, or it goes to a wastewater plant, that percolates down in. There's a cycle there too, where a significant source of water is, you know, the water that percolates down through, and you pump it up again. So, other questions? Yes.
The lowest area seems to be right in the center of the face off of Highway 1. Does the groundwater collect from other areas to go in to replenish that?
Question. Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, there's some things that catch your eye right away in the Pomo Mesa. One of them, of course, the lakes that are out on the west. Whenever a groundwater geologist sees lakes, there are kind of a couple things that come to mind as possibilities. One of them is that there's no way for that water to go. It doesn't have an outlet, and it's surface water that's collected there. Another possibility is that there's actually been discharge from the aquifers into that area because it's a low-lying area. In this case, we think that those coastal areas where we have the lakes, for instance, are not good recharge areas. We think one of the reasons, we think it's probably that water has come partly from surface runoff and partly from some of the very shallow aquifers that have drained into that area, but the water doesn't have any place to go because it's sitting on a clay layer. It isn't getting down into the main aquifer where most of the wells are drilled. So that's probably not what the one thing we do know probably most about the basin is the closer you get to the ocean, the more sure you are that there are clay layers that separate the surface from the ground. And actually, that's good, because if we didn't have that, if we had sand all the way from the surface all the way down to the aquifer, then as soon as we got to the ocean, we'd have seawater percolating. And so we do have a clay layer that's protecting us from seawater, at least that kind of seawater that would be near the surface.
To follow up on that a little bit, the contour maps that we showed you have that depression in the middle. The elevations that are underlying those lines that we've drawn on the map are elevations of what we call a potentiometric surface. It's the pressure surface. Even though underneath that clay layer water exists, it may be under pressure and exerts a potentiometric surface that may be above that clay layer where there is no water. And so the apparent, what we see in that decline in the potentiometric surface is in the center, which you noted. What we know from physics is that water flows from high potential to low potential. So the answer is yes. Water from the adjacent infills that cone.
But not necessarily from the surface at that point.
Not necessarily from the surface. It may be from the adjacent, and it may not be equally in all directions. There may be preferential places from which that water will flow into that cone of depression, if you will, of the potentiometric surface. We do not understand the structure well enough to be able to say water flows equally from all places.
Oh, how does the area that you discussed the traffic water from the basin relate to the Santa Maria water basin converted? The losses is from the whole works, so are we any different than that, or basically the same thing I asked before, is our area connected underground actual aquifer for the water to be transferred out to flow?
Well, the water does flow under the mesa and also in the valley. The thing about the mesa is that most of the stuff you see above the elevation of the valley floor is sand. It's the windblown sand dune complex, which just has covered this area with hundreds of feet of sand. But once you get below that, you get into more of a clay and gravel and sand and marine deposit sequence. And so those lower zones do carry across the both parts of the basin.
And our contours that we draw carry right across those boundaries too. So those boundaries are kind of administrative boundaries rather than geologic boundaries, which is happens a lot in water. Sometimes it's impractical when you do it. Makes it very important to collaborate with those areas on either side where you look. You know,
you're drawing different contours across a radically different definition there.
Another one. Since we have microclimates around here, various areas, lap water, areas drained by rainfall. We have some areas which seem very close. A lot of rainfall, and we see after the rains a great deal of difference just in between the cities on the mesa, below the mesa, wherever. Does that equalize at all into the aquifer where it really doesn't make a lot of difference if you're within the same aquifer area, but it's all going to come down to the bottom of the basic area?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well stated.
Maybe not on a detailed scale, but on a general scale, that's true.
Well, and of course, the other thing is the Santa Maria River, where it flows, it recharges a great deal of water into the groundwater. And so that, I mean, when you see rainfall, when it runs off, it focuses on those areas, and that's where you get the big recharge of the flows.
Yes?
One of your charts on the findings, it says total estimated groundwater production. How do you guys estimate that for all the individual wells that are put into the Pueblo Mesa that are not under your control? Or under an individual water company's control?
Yeah, no, excellent question.
I think the operative word there is estimate. I mean, we do have meter data from the purveyors that provide that, and certainly we welcome any private person who would like to offer up meter data to help us resolve these numbers to a much lesser degree of uncertainty. But we do go through a standard technical practice that we look at and quantify for instance, crops that are grown and what those crop requirements would be for water. That gives us an estimate of what water must have been produced to grow those crops. And that's one way by which we can make an estimate of water that is pumped from the groundwater. And we do that in as much rigor as we can, and there are large uncertainties around making these estimates, and we're aware of that. But it is, you know, the first order estimate that we can make.
And we haven't assigned quantities to individual wells in that situation. We assigned it more to the land because that's how the estimate's made. So. And we don't know what the plumbing is in many of these situations anyway. Whose well irrigates whose land, et cetera. So that's why we're looking at a larger scale picture.
And it is better than just get an aerial image, and if it's green, you do one thing and it's not. The county produces crop numbers, acreages, all that stuff, so the data is, it's a decent estimate.
I was just trying to understand how you calculate the agricultural versus the urban.
Right.
I guess that's urban, right?
Yep.
And how do you calculate that if you don't get accurate data from wells that people are utilizing, whether it's agriculture or people? Because agriculture definitely runs a very high gamut of efficiency of use of water.
Does it?
Okay, and if you have large amounts of agriculture that is usually inefficient, how do you estimate that versus those that are very efficient?
This is a problem in every basin in California. You know, it has to be, unless everyone's on a meter, and there are very few basins that are that situation. So that's, we've had to kind of do what everyone else has to do with the estimates.
And I understand that, and I guess my question is really more related to something other than, I guess, you're going to present tonight, which is if we're going to be doing supplemental water, how do we know how the supplemental water is being used, or how it's being recharged, and who's paying, and all the other related stuff. I mean, so, I mean, if I don't know who's using the water, I don't know who should be paying for it.
Well, at this point, supplemental water is it's an urban source, not meant for ag purposes. So it will be a metered source to go out to customers. We'll also have meters. So it'll be a well-tracked source, unlike some of the agricultural production, which is less well-tracked.
Okay, but that means that if the water is not being directly used, that means it's going into the groundwater to recharge it.
Well, I mean, it'd be used by the customers or the purveyors, at least as a first use.
and being used instead of the purveyors pumping their well. Right. So what it does is take some of the stress off the aquifer.
So all those people with individual wells out there are going to connect up to the water service?
No, just those who are customers of the purveyors. So if you have an individual well on a 2.5 acre piece, you may not see any physical supplemental water yourself. You'll just continue to pump your well as you have, and the purveyors will receive that supplemental water, deliver that to their customers, and that's how the water comes to the basin.
Instead of pumping.
Right, instead of pumping.
It's called in lieu recharge, which means you're delivering it in lieu of somebody pumping it instead.
Right.
So it's actually a very effective way of recharging.
And I understand it. So I came for the supplemental water so everybody else can pump the groundwater at a much cheaper rate than I get from pumping the groundwater.
Right. And that's a very common scenario throughout the county. Those of us who have small utilities, we're all paying our share, because the purveyors are usually the ones who step up to that type of a project, and that's almost always what happens. It can be frustrating. Good questions. Other questions? Yeah.
You might mention the fact that people that own the property, that have drilled the wells and are pumping, have an overlying right to that water.
Well said. Just a second. That in California water law, there's some attorneys who understand that much better than I do. Actually, in the room, they want to speak. If you own a piece of property and you have a well, you have a senior or a higher right than if you were just a purveyor pumping water for the purpose of delivering it to your customers. So that's an important consideration. Good. Thank you. Yes.
Do you have any idea how many wells there are in Utah?
Wow.
Come on, throw a number out there.
Oh my goodness. There's probably 500 wells. Mm-hmm. That's just
lots of straws.
All the wells that are potentially available to us to collect data and track the status of the basin, and that short list of wells that we have good information on and good confidence in that do get measured regularly are part of the subset that we use for the regular monitoring.
And you know, we didn't say that, but one of the advantages we had here was the county has been doing monitoring for some period of time now, twice a year throughout the county, a lot of wells in the Pomo Mesa. And we work with them closely. We've identified some wells that we hope they add or have added, and we use their information. So we have a lot of historic data, which was very, very helpful. Looking to see how the basin's changed with time.
Okay. Has everybody else finished their questions? As a guy from the Woodlands said one time, let's step it up a notch. My wife and I own a nursery on Eucalyptus Road, just so people know. I was sued by NCSD in March of 1999 in the groundwater litigation. I didn't sign the partial settlement, which includes the technical process. And that case, which is currently going through the appellate court, is waiting for some paperwork and then a final decision. I also have been incorrectly identified that I'm an ag operation, not a residential development, as being included in the assessment for the WIP project that you're suggesting, to the tune of about $100,000. And NCSD and the county are using a map, of which I believe I have the original, that says this map is not to be used by public agencies because it's not determinative of the exact parcels. And I have a letter from Roger Brett that says your parcel is not included. So the county's using your map from page 4. So the question is, where did you get that map? Did you check it for accuracy? And who removed the disclaimer on it? And is it authorized for use by the county as a basis for Golden State Water Company service area, which I'm not part of? I don't have Golden State service.
Rob, can I make a suggestion that this setting is to deal with technical issues involved in the annual report?
Yes, that's page 4 of the annual report, and I'm just asking what the databases is. of that. That's Mr. Saperstein, Golden State Water Company's attorney.
And Mr. Schneider, I'm not suggesting the question is inappropriate. This isn't the forum for it. So I'm sure folks at NCSD and Golden State would be happy to answer your question. You're talking to the technical group, not to the folks that are responsible.
Are you acknowledging then that the technical group didn't come up with the map that was given to them by the attorney, and therefore they're not responsible for the mistake?
As I said, I don't believe it's appropriate.
Okay. Well, let's move on then.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that.
Okay, let's move on. Objection noted by Mr. Saperstein.
All right.
On a positive note, usually I only have 3 minutes to talk, so I don't usually pretty negative. I appreciate the work you guys are doing, and I think the fact that you elected to limit the quantitative analysis in this report because of a substantial lack of data is a new way to go here in Samurai Groundwater Basin. I think it's much more honest than pulling a number out of the air and sticking it in the report and then having the government process that through and make decisions. It's a sad note, though, that the lawyers limited the attendance to the technical committee to those who signed the settlement that have to support the WIP project. And that results in information coming out, and then we don't know where it comes from. For example, Ed Eby, who's an NCSD board member, reported that this group sanctioned the DWR 2002 safe yield numbers of 4,800 to 6,000 acre feet. Actually, it was called a dependable yield. He called it a safe yield. And that the only two numbers you really had to look at in this report was that and the 12,000 acre foot pumpage number to know what the shortage is. So did you guys sanction the DWR number for its historical period of 84 to 75? Did you sanction it for the current date? And did you sanction it for the use in comparing to the pumping number? I'll just go through all the questions, and you can
shoot. That's the last one. We didn't sanction. We're really kind of. You know,
okay. I put the answer down
just
here.
Just unless we come up with it, we don't believe it.
All right. I just want to know because that came out. On page 36, you show a considerable variability in the production or the pumping number. I mean, you can see that it just bounces all up and down. You support the WIP project. But the WIP project, the current cost is based on an existing shortage, is the term that's being used. And that's critical as to the ratio of who has to pay, who is already here versus future development. And so my question is, has the technical group approved an existing shortage number? And does the technical group have any documentation to support the exact date of the existing shortage that's being used? It's supposedly 2,500 acre feet of existing shortage.
Those kind of answers, if we were going to publish them, they'd be published in the annual report.
All right, very good. The settlement states that stipulating parties agree and conversely not oppose in any way or encourage or assist any other person in opposing or challenging the MOU, the environmental regulatory permits, et cetera, for the intertie project, and you're under that. Have you disclosed that you have an obligation to support that because the lawyers told you to in the report?
Yes. And, for instance, in the mutual, Woodlands Mutual, we talked very candidly to our shareholders about that.
No, but I'm saying in the technical report, I did not find a statement that says the stipulation requires us to support this WIP project.
I see what you're saying.
Okay. I take it the answer was no.
No, it's not in there.
Okay, good. I guessed correctly then. Before I was thrown out of the first technical group meeting, records show that decisions were made partially by attorneys, since none of the actual technical people threw me out. Is there a record in that group of which decisions are made by the attorneys versus which are made by the technical members that's available to the public? I guess no.
I don't know what meeting you're referring to. I was
all
there
of them.
Some of the initial meetings. I would say this group functions as a technical group.
Okay.
It truly does.
All right. I only was in the meeting for about 10 minutes before I got given the boot.
Sure, we were not going to turn a deaf ear to legal advice, but we're dealing with technical issues on a technical level.
Okay.
And you might have heard something, because we were having to do bylaws and things like that, you know, early on, so we probably had some legal advice then, but...
So you've shifted...
You don't listen.
Oh,
just
okay.
Find
your layers.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
That's not true.
No, I appreciate the kettles. Okay, there's no court order requiring that anyone reduce pumping right now. What prevents, if you have the WIP project, you know, that's supposedly to reduce pumping, but if pumping is just increased to support new development back up to the same level, you're really not getting anywhere. So is there anything that you have in your report that guarantees that there won't just be a temporary dip because you're replacing water and then have it just go right back up as soon as development kicks back in to the same spot we're in right now? So we're not really solving an existing problem effectively.
This is a 2009 annual report focused on that water year.
Okay,
in the future, if we see conditions that are going the wrong direction, such as excessive well drilling and pumping and so forth, then this technical group's not a one-shot deal. It's year after year for the health and space.
And now another term that's in the technical report is as soon as possible concerning the water intertie project. That's also in the settlement. Are you guys using that in a legal sense or a technical sense? And how many days is as soon as possible? That's kind of a trick question.
It is. I won't take a shot at that one, John.
Okay. I know
what
my answer.
Technical versus legal as soon as possible.
Mr. Newton, because it all gets down to like when we have to do it, you know. And so now, Brad Newton here has had a I guess you'd call it a technical memorandum that once stated a three-dimensional model would be needed to temporally estimate when seawater would intrude. So, does the technical committee currently have a conclusive three-dimensional model that shows if seawater will intrude? And does it have a conclusive analysis to show when it will intrude? In other words, if I got to spend $100,000, can I put my kids through college first and then do the WIP project? Or must I do the WIP project now, assuming I was actually in it? Have you done any of that analysis?
I think it's very important that, Steve, you're probably chomping a bit on that one, that if this would benefit the whole group, John, so if you give Steve a second to talk about the difference between a numerical model to manage versus physical factors to manage.
Yeah, I do a lot of work with seawater and treatment. So.
Thank you.
The reason that we're so concentrated on some of the coastal wells is because every basin that has ever had seawater intrusion has one thing that happens first, and that is that the coastal wells go below sea level, or at least go deep enough that that you're causing a gradient from the ocean to push the seawater in. If you don't have that, you just don't get seawater intrusion. And so keeping those wells, the water levels at those wells are the first thing that we look at. We do that quarterly, and boy, we've got our eyes peeled on that one. And so what we can say right now is that the two things. One is that the water levels have stayed up where they've been historically, so we don't expect that seawater is even on its way in at this point. We also look, because we do have the pumping depression farther inland, what happens between that pumping depression and the coast. Because we want to make sure that pumping depression doesn't extend out to the coast, because then the water levels are down off the coast. So those are the things that we're really concerned about, and those are the very first things we really look at when we do our contours. And of course, a groundwater model, a flow model, is just that. It's a model. You have to have a really good understanding of all the geology to have it work. One of the biggest, trickiest things, even if we had a good groundwater model right now, we do want to have one at some point, is that what happens to the aquifers that goes out underneath the ocean? We know that it isn't connected directly there, because we know we have this confining layer that at least, you know, goes out to the edge of the ocean. What we don't know is where that aquifer actually, you know, has contact with the ocean. many cases in down in Ventura County, where I do a lot of work, there's some big submarine canyons that cut the aquifer, and so you know exactly where that point is, and sometimes it's only a mile offshore, and then you can get a pretty good estimate of how much time you have once you take those water levels down. We don't know that, so even with a good model right now, we're not sure where we put that boundary. You might be conservative and bring it really close to shore. But again, we don't have to worry about that right now because we haven't set up the conditions that seawater is moving on shore. And really, I think what we're all aimed at here is to make sure those conditions never do occur on the mesa.
And I think one of the challenges, being I've got some involvement in other service areas that triggered seawater intrusion, now, okay, we need to do something. It takes so long to pull off a major public works project, years, that if you wait until the conditions are such that you're triggering it and you have active seawater intrusion now, can you move fast enough to really get something done? And I think other service areas have found that no, you can't. By the time you actually get the thing delivering water, you know, now you're behind. You've lost some of that aquifer.
Yeah, you've got very, very proactive. Really proactive. And, of course, one of the reasons we're talking about supplemental water here is we do have this pumping depression.
Yeah.
All right. Can I finish my list here?
Although we generated a few. Go ahead.
Let me finish my list.
Don't forget your question.
Don't forget your question. I want to hear it. The 1998 water master plan for the county showed a surplus of 6,000 acre feet when you considered the Napomo Mesa and what I call the triangle in the Santa Maria Valley that's in San Luis Obispo County. The lawyers basically chose what I call the yellow line that surrounds the Napomo Mesa. Are you guys restricted to just looking inside that yellow line now, or can you expand the scope and possibilities outside into that large area that, when considered as a whole, might be considered to have more water?
We certainly look beyond our boundaries for the purpose of understanding groundwater conditions, but we still have to be respectful of the efforts of the other management areas. I say it's a gray area. I mean, for instance, the northern cities, we're working very closely with them on a bi-monthly basis. As long as we come to that shared understanding where the data isn't neglected because it's near the boundary, I think both groups benefit from understanding it. So I think our view can be broader, and it is.
Okay. It's talking about the Twitchell Management Authority area, which is Scott Scalmanini, looking at that, Mr. Scalmanini. He provided a perennial yield, which is for the groundwater basin, which is an amount of water you can pump out continuously without harming the basin, but not a maximum safe yield. So he never put a maximum limit. He just said, if you keep doing what you're doing, we can continue pumping that amount. And he clearly stated there's been no analysis of the maximum amount that can be pumped out of the groundwater basin as a whole. But he also has commented, and I don't have the exact quote, but there's been no technical analysis to essentially ensure that there's a water supply to put into the WIP pipeline on the San Marino end, although there might be now, not necessarily, you know, out. There's been no analysis of whether it will be out in the future. Is this group going to analyze the water supply maximum on a whole, because it's got to be pumped out from somewhere, and its reliability and its effect on us depends on that? And is it going to analyze whether there's going to be water put into that pipe for the next, say, 100 years for its operation?
Not really within our purview.
I guess no. Okay. And of course, the other question is, we have a court process that's ongoing, which questions exactly who can pump what. So I assume you guys haven't done any legal analysis, because maybe there will be water, but who can be sure who will be able to pump it? Whether Santa Maria will be able to pump that and supply that up here, I'm not really sure. I guess no, we haven't done any legal analysis.
But John, it's not in our mandate to do.
Okay, but you're recommending the project, though, even though those questions are out there.
We do believe that the project will deliver significant quantities of truly supplemental surface water based on the current blend.
Well, I'll move right along. I only got two more questions left. You have a demand number of 12,200 acre feet for the Napoleon Mesa, and a lot of that is an ag increase. Do you consider all that water to be taken from direct, the yellow line, from directly under the yellow line, or are you also looking at water that's being piped across the yellow line from areas outside the Napomo Mesa, or, as I believe, if you look at the strawberries to the south down here, the wells might not be on the yellow line or on the other side of the yellow line, but they're right on the yellow line or right next to it, so essentially the water is coming from the Santa Maria River, not from the bluff area, but up by the sewer plant. And allegedly there's pipes that take water from the bluff all the way under the orchard and then to the other side. So, you know, if you take an aerial photograph, you've got thousands of acre feet of water pumpage, but it effectively is coming out of the Santa Maria area of the basin. So is that delineated somewhere in the report? And I know there's other cases of pipes going from one side to the other.
It's not a well by well analysis.
Okay, but you're assuming the
land use.
It's a land use, so it assumes that the pumping occurs in the boundary of the land.
Okay, so that's probably a bogus assumption.
There may be some modifications.
That's what we call an estimate.
Okay.
Best estimate.
My last question here is, I got one more because you talked about it. So the numbers and analysis that you guys have done previously was based on the boundary that Mr. Beebe used at the Phase 3 trial, which was smaller than the whole Napomo management area. Have you expanded your work and analysis now so it covers the whole thing? It got cut off essentially at the railroad tracks or Highway 1. I don't know which is the exact boundary.
We have modified that boundary.
Like the water in, you had water in storage numbers.
We used the boundary of the NMMA as was presented today.
Okay, the bigger one.
That's the boundary we used.
Okay, and now my last question, really. You guys have talked about the Osa Flacco well, the one that's missing. I personally spent a lot of time looking for that. I have a pretty good idea of what bush it's under.
did you find it?
Just get the shovel out. Start digging.
Okay, well, that's my question. You specifically, and those wells are important. That's why I did that. Everybody should work on that. You said that is under 30 feet of sand. And I'm wondering where you got that number, because that's considerably different than I thought.
Glenn Britton, who knows where it's located, said it varies well under the sand.
Okay.
And I think he did use a number like 30 feet. We don't know. It could be 5 feet. It could be 1, but I don't know. We just can't find the darn thing.
Okay.
And he knows probably where it is because he's been there any time, but he's retired.
Well, I actually personally asked him to go out there with me, and we took a stroll.
Okay.
And he was unable to locate it, but had some good tips.
There you go.
But I did take all of the photographs, historical photographs, which was quite a number, and have a specific spot. But it is, in my opinion, it's under 12 feet of sand, but there's so many bottle caps from the beer drinking that was occurring in the 70s and 80s that you can't use a magnetic detector. So I don't know whether you guys have more sophisticated... We're talking $100,000 to drill a new well. This is important.
Where we're looking at putting
it.
What?
Is that personal knowledge? Those are beer bottles?
Yes, because I think you went out there with me. I went out with Bill Dineen, and he talked about the guys out there, and, you know, what goes with dune buggies but beer.
At this time, we have a new location for monitoring wells, which would be actually far better than the old one.
Yes, but that's still a valuable well. So do you guys have sophisticated magnetic analysis? Because I think it's only under about 12 feet of sand, maybe 15 tops.
You know, I think that we are open, very open, to finding that existing well. If that well was available to us, we would use it. We would rehabilitate it, we would use it.
Okay.
So any information you have that would aid us in locating that well, I think we'd be very open to receiving that from you and considering that. I don't think there's anybody would question that whatsoever. If that was a viable well.
Well, maybe at some point when you guys are not in a meeting that I can't go to, you could come by, and then we could have a not meeting and discuss where the photographs show that well is most likely to be and I'm available for that. And then
just one quick thing on that, John, is that if we do rehabilitate that well, the ability to access it with the Clover issues and so forth, the well location that we were thinking of right by the bathrooms there could be a very secure location. Over a long period of time, having a new well that's in a prime location may be a good thing.
I would disagree. If I had $100,000, I'd probably chip into the WIP, and if I had another $100,000, we'd go for that,
right on.
That well. But I don't. And that well is not that far from the existing service road, so I don't know that it's a Clover problem.
Just searching and digging for it. But fair enough. I mean,
Okay. And let me ask, because
I mean, you know, one of the things that we would look into is whether or not the integrity of the casing exists.
Exactly.
I mean, the measurement hasn't been made out of that well for many, many years. We have no idea if it's collapsed, if it's corroded away. We don't know anything about it.
Well, it's supposed to be plastic, and it was done in 97. So
maybe we don't know. We have no idea. So we're, if it's plastic, then we're not going to find it with any kind of metal detector.
But it's got a metal top on it. So,
but whatever, we're happy to find it if we can.
And then the Arroyo Grande well, because you guys have got an area of concern. There's one at Arroyo Grande Creek, and I don't know whether anybody's actually looked for that, because that's also, to me, a critical monitoring.
That's up in the North Cities area.
But if you look at your map, though, you got two wells, an area of concern, and it's just, it's in their area on the other side of this magic lawyer yellow line, but it's still
right.
A relevant well for us.
I can't say that. I personally looked for it, but I think one of my staff was looking for it.
All right. Well, that's all my questions.
If you find it, we'll pass that information on.
Okay. And is the dinner deal still on? Because last year you said I get dinner if I could find it.
Yeah, let's see it. Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I got to make a better metal detector.
Taco. There were some other questions that Mr. Schneider triggered. Yes.
We have a question.
Want to go first?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. All right.
Couple questions. This advisory group that you had, what percentage of the water pumping capacity, volume, whatever, you guys represent?
Ooh, what a good question.
I mean,
40%, 50%?
This question raises that as that if you're putting in a well that's $100,000 and you only represent a small amount of people who is just the facts, how is the funding funneled to everybody that is protecting or making decisions on? Or based upon your math, how many people or how many cubic feet or acre feet do you guys represent in the overall model relative to the whole thing? And the other question I had was, when you estimate your average well value and stuff, and you're looking at whether or not there's a problem or not, are you averaging them as a quantity, or are you averaging them by the amount of area that they are covering? Because if it's just by wells, if there's a whole bunch of wells in the depression involved and very few in areas where there is large amounts of water, you're not estimating or indicating the correct amount of potential issues for severe drought versus whatever.
We talked a lot about that. So we think we have you can never be perfect on it, but we think we have good geographical representation, so that we aren't biasing it one way or the other.
But we do want to answer the percentage question. Someone pull that percentage while we were.
I think first order estimate, if we looked at the map of the colored polygons on the NMMA area, the proportion of those to the area would be your first order guess of what the contribution of production is or what the consumption use is for that. But over the whole.
But you can pick through that. It's over 50%.
In the annual report, it is listed in one of the tables.
Yeah,
you can read the value.
Urban industrial, 7,400.
Page 33.
Okay. Yeah, so it's over. Yeah, it's over 50%.
I guess what brings that question on is, I may be one of the ones that get supplemental water and stuff like that. But if the potential is that in the Pomo Mesa could be overcome anyway, because you have no control over the other people, and some personal person could put a well in and drain the aquifer dry if there is no limitations to people's ability to pump water. What are you guys' ability to manage the whole Napoleon Mesa when you only, if you only represent a small amount of the potential for fixing the water problems?
I'd give a lawyer's one to that. You know, we still report to the court, you know, every year. And if something goes south that we can't do anything about, you know, and we see a problem, there's somebody who's going to go take it back to the court.
The court can cover all those individual well operations.
You know, more fundamental to your question is that the technical group, in its charge, is not to manage the basin. Our charge is to evaluate and report. And we provide data and information to managers to make decisions. But we aren't those managers, and we don't make those decisions. We don't address policy. You know, and a lot of questions perhaps we heard tonight were policy-driven questions. That's out of what we do. That is not part of our domain.
No, okay, so you're a technical group to the group that ability to manage what they cover. There's a lot of the Napoleon Mesa that those people do not manage. Who manages the people not in that management group?
I mean, that's the classic. We hear that is the question that comes up in every group that has significant ag contribution to a groundwater management issue. Why aren't they paying? How can we manage them? The only thing we know is that in many of these areas, we see from 20, 30 years ago to now, a consistent cropping pattern, a consistent use of water. We know that the state is making steps towards requiring at least the bigger farming operations to report their management practices and all that. But in California, it's just not there. I mean, eventually it'll be there.
Yeah, and I understand. I'm looking at the proverbial as if somebody has a river running through their land, and they decide to dam it, it affects millions of other people potentially downstream.
Right. Now, they couldn't do that under California law. You can't just build a dam. You can use only that amount of water that you can beneficially put to use on your property. And that's why, you know, a lot of the urban communities end up being the more proactive. Now, we do have an ag representative on our group, mm-hmm. which Northern Cities, you know, doesn't have one, so we benefit from that voice. But they don't have a financial stake at this point. You know, it often gets to the urban purveyors to take the proactive steps to build a new monitoring well and so forth. And there's some frustration there, but it's reality in California right now.
So, Ian, as your map showed, the depression at Royal Grande, in the area of Royal Grande, where let's say they overpump and they suck the pumping band to make it better. How do you control that?
The court would definitely come in.
That wouldn't go too long before the court got involved.
We could say in our annual report, hey, look, here's what we see on our boundary. We see an increasingly severe condition in this area. Some action needs to occur. You know, that's why we're doing the monitoring.
I mean, the basin's in better shape than that for most because there is an adjudication. For most people, they'd have to start an adjudication, but we're already here. Being supervised by the court.
Down the road with the court.
Yeah.
And aside from the worst case scenario, we are actively working with the Northern Cities Management Area, and we conduct meetings to try to evaluate the fact that we are connected and that what happens you know, in a single place may affect other people. And so we work together to understand the water supply and the condition. And it's an active ongoing process. But the worst case scenario is something that we do need to consider. And our job as evaluators and reporters, we would be doing that on a regular basis.
Three questions.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Is there any indication in any of the three management areas that they've had any saltwater intrusion?
There is a technical report of Northern Cities that if you haven't read it, it's It's a riveting reading, and then there is some indication they had some evidence there of intrusion in one of their coastal wells. So those in the website link that you have in your handout, you can also get to that management report if you're interested in that.
And the other thing that I would like your opinion on, what percent is the water in the 4 or 5 sewer plants is actually getting into the recharging the aquifers?
Well, nobody like a Tim Fleet to want Tim on the back.
Oh boy. Well, there's for the wastewater plants here and the disposal facilities here in Pomo Mesa, much of the water is being used on golf courses. And then there is the Southland Wastewater Treatment Plant disposal site for the Pomo CSD. And they percolate the water, and that does go in the groundwater basin. How it gets into the deeper zones, we don't totally understand that. We know there's some confining layers. But it does go into the ground. And so there is that portion that does go into the groundwater.
And it wasn't, yeah, we put ours in a lined pond and we recycle it on the golf course. I think Black Lake does the same. Yes.
It's a little Cypress,
right? Yeah. Yeah, and Cypress, sure. Good, hold on.
So that raises the question for the technical group. If most of the homeowners are using the water for irrigation of their plants, and the rest of the water is going down to the sewage plant, which is recirculating water into it, why is there such an overdraft of the groundwater relative to the urban uses and stuff like that? I don't see how there's such a potential large imbalance.
Yeah, in terms of how much water, when water comes into your property, how much water goes back to the sewer plant, it's less than half. And a lot of it's being applied on the outside for landscaping and the like. And a portion of that also goes down into the groundwater too, but probably over half is consumed and poof, it's gone.
Yeah, the bigger the lot, you'd be amazed at the percentage of outdoor versus indoor. And a nice 10,000 square foot lot, you use 70-80% on the outdoor. Even in our service area where we have a very small flow compared to our number of homes, a lot of second homes, but a lot of flow for outdoor irrigation, again, maybe 70-80%. So it's, our outdoor uses are significant. So often those are consumptive uses. They consume the water. And
it doesn't percolate back in the ground.
Only the amount that you use over and above with plantings. Yeah, there's some. There's some that does go back after you irrigate. Sure. Sure, someone will.
And it can be complicated because what does percolate back into the ground may or may not percolate back into the same aquifer that was being pumped.
Right, it might hit something shallow and just move sideways and never get into the zone where you actually pump it again.
You're bringing up all the things that we're trying to calculate.
Yeah.
in essence, the question is if we get enough rain to, as you indicate, backflow. Where is all the water going to that's pulled off if it's not into either evaporation or in a plant growth? The rest of it, if Woodlands is pumping their sewage plant and recirculating it back into Monarch Dunes or into the groundwater and stuff like that, then we have lots of evaporation.
Evaporation, evapotranspiration, that's where the water actually gets consumed.
And we very likely have a little bit of a flow to the ocean as well.
Sure.
Through, and with, that's what you want.
You got to have a flow.
Got it. If you aren't having flow to the ocean, you're having flow back, which you don't want to have. But you don't want to have a half of your water going in the ocean, which clearly is not.
Very good. More lively bunch here this year. I like this. The other zingers? Jesse.
Have you guys done a calculation of basically how much flow is actually going to the ocean in terms of percent versus use?
No, not yet. We're going to get there.
One of the problems with that is to be able to do it, you know, it's the gradient, that the groundwater gradient that matters. And one of the things you have to know to do that correctly is to be able to say what the gradient is if you go offshore. Well, that depends in part on where the contact is with the ocean, because that controls what the point out there is. And if it's shallow, it's less. If it's deeper, it's more. So it's a non-trivial thing to do.
Would you be doing that over just the area of the lawyer's yellow line, or, you know, essentially some of our flow that needs to go to the ocean has to go through the lower end of Zone 3 in the northern cities before it goes to the ocean? So, you know what I'm saying?
Well,
that's kind of an odd shape. So
everything works together. You're right.
Yeah. So,
and that's why we feel it's important to work with some of the other technical groups to evaluate.
Yeah. I'm saying if you come up with a percentage, it's going to be kind of funny if you only have like the little tail of the dog there.
Yes. You're right.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, more of a comment or perhaps a clarification. The gentleman was asked about water being drawn out of wells that water in the woodlands and getting recharged. If I recall, the wells are at several hundred feet, are potable water wells.
Yeah, deep.
3,600 feet.
And we have at least one aquifer from the discussion that is very shallow, less than 100 feet.
There's a separate shallow aquifer there at Monarch Dunes,
right. So
which is one reason why we don't just percolate the wastewater. We treat it. We reuse it on the golf course, because if we just percolated at that location, it might just get into that first layer.
Good. And I guess that was the point I want to make. It means quite probable that water coming out of deep aquifer going through the entire above ground process and then perking back in the ground may never reach the deep aquifers again. It may settle in the shallow ones.
Right.
That was actually the point I was trying to make a minute ago.
Well, you know, it got done in the first place. So there is most likely a mechanism for getting it there. How the rate at which it gets there and the pressure type of how it flows and all is probably not a simple thing to deal with. And that would be what we have to try and define. We're working on that.
So for that gentleman's comment, though, is if there is a shallower aquifer there and it's one that we're recharging based on reuse and stuff, why would we not draw on that?
Well, part of the problem is that you don't get a huge amount of water out of the wells in that. You know, I've seen wells that will do, well, maybe 50, 60 gallons a minute out of those shallow aquifers, but not 500. It's in sand zone, so the sands are, dune sands are fairly fine and fairly not high permeability like some of the gravel zones, of coarse sand, marine deposits that are deeper.
So you don't get the good production. But over time, I mean, you might see those areas tapped for irrigation supplies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just, you
know. Relative to the supplemental water pipeline coming from Santa Maria, what's the source of that water?
Santa Maria delivers a blend to their customers. Twitchell, state water, have significant state water, groundwater, it's a blend. And so that would be the blended source.
And the state water comes to them which way?
All the way from the coastal branch, all the way from Northern California.
So that was, I guess I read somewhere, a person asked a question of the technical group, why is the pipeline that's on the coastal group area not being tapped into before it goes to Santa Maria?
Well, that's a great question. That's probably outside the purview of this area. There's a really good answer to that. In fact, there's a technical analysis on the POMO's website of the cost of that. And there's a very complicated legal framework to tap into that line with a whole group of cities and purveyors outside this group to talk about that. But there's a good technical analysis.
Where is that?
It's on the website.
Three.
At least it used to be on the website. On NCSDs. Yeah.
My question was, does the clay layer that separates the two aquifers underneath Highway 1 there by the coast, does that go out continuously all the way to the ocean, or does it merge back together and that water help the lower aquifer either by connecting directly or semi-permeable push the ocean.
We don't know. We don't think so. We think at least in some areas it goes off because in the coastal wells we have different water levels, a little bit of trend. And of course, again, if some of that's connected right to the ocean and you get some seawater in, you can have that, you can have the clay lens as well. So, but we're not sure that's true every place. And historically, one of the other pieces of evidence we have about how, where this clay layer is, too, is historically, before there was pumping, or very much pumping, there were a lot of artesian wells. And artesian wells, you really do have to have a confining layer and a confined aquifer that's pressured up down below it. And that line comes pretty far through the mesa from some of the old wells. Now, there weren't that many old wells, but there was a significant amount was under artesian pressure.
Going once, going twice. Thank you very much. We'll hang out for a bit if you have further questions.
Better metal detector.